And we proceed now to the third case of the day, Mason versus SmithKline Beckham, case 08-2265. Mr. Ifandari.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. It has remained a central premise of federal drug regulation that the manufacturer bears responsibility for the content of its label at all times. Those are the words of the United States Supreme Court in Wyeth versus Levine. In Levine, the Supreme Court rejected the manufacturer and the FDA's broad preemption arguments. In so doing, it definitively held that state failure to warn claims are not preempted absent clear evidence that the FDA would not have approved a labeling change. Since following appellate courts across the country, including this court and City of Joliet, have applied Levine and refused to find preemption in a myriad of different contexts. In the context of prescription drugs, and specifically in the context of Paxil, which is the drug at issue in this case, every court since Levine has held that Paxil-induced suicidality claims are not preempted by federal law. One of those decisions was issued by a district court from within this circuit, and I'm referring to the July 2009 Forrest decision issued by Judge Stottmuller. Forrest involved a 60-year-old adult patient who alleged that Paxil induced his 2004 suicide attempt. In rejecting GSK's preemption argument, Judge Stottmuller relied upon Levine, analyzed GSK's evidence, and correctly held that GSK had failed to present clear evidence that the FDA would have rejected a suicide warning. If there's no preemption in Forrest, then it follows that there can be no preemption in this case, which involves the tragic suicide of 23-year-old Tricia Mason. The Masons therefore respectfully contend that the district court below committed error in finding their claims preempted by the Food and Drug Cosmetic Act. As Levine recognized, when Congress enacted the FDCA, it did not intend to preempt state law. Following its enactment in 1938, manufacturers occasionally moved for preemption. However, their arguments were virtually always rejected by courts. In fact, prior to 2008, no federal appellate court had ever found preemption in a prescription drug context. The first decision to find preemption was the Third Circuit's 2008 Colachico decision. In Colachico, the Third Circuit, relying upon the FDA's recently enacted preemption policies as outlined in amicus briefs, as well as a 2006 FDA preamble, concluded that the plaintiff's claims were preempted. The district court below in this case, relying wholesale upon the Third Circuit's Colachico decision, likewise concluded that the Mason's claims are preempted. However, both Colachico as well as the district court below's decision were decided prior to the Supreme Court's seminal decision in Levine. Levine confirms that both Colachico as well as the district court below committed error. In Levine, the court rejected the manufacturer and the FDA's preemption arguments. It further rejected the FDA's pro-preemption amicus briefs, and it also rejected the 2006 pro-preemption preamble, which it found to be at odds with congressional intent. Levine has resulted in a domino effect.
Well, let me just interrupt you. It seems to me that this tips on what is meant by clear evidence.
I agree, Your Honor.
And how would you define that? What does that mean?
Well, I think the answer lies in Levine. A close read of Levine shows that the manufacturer in that case actually proposed some different warning. And the dissent in Levine actually concluded that based on the fact that the manufacturer proposed something in 1987 that the FDA eventually rejected and said no, retain current verbiage, and the fact that the drug had been on the market for 50 years and the FDA had been analyzing the risk of amputation associated with fenugreek, that all of those warranted a finding of preemption. The majority, however, disagreed and said that even those facts do not warrant preemption, and those facts did not constitute clear evidence. In this case, GSK never even bothered to propose an enhanced warning to the FDA. Rather, it just reacted to whatever the FDA told it to do.
But as I understand the FDA in this area of antidepressants, they try to treat all of these drugs, whether it's Effexor or Prozac or Paxil kind of as a class. And even as when it was recently done where they had the increased warning, the FDA said, no, we'll give the class warning. And so if they treat it like a class, how do you deal with the fact that in the mid-90s, somebody brought a claim asking for a specific warning in the Prozac context, and the FDA declined and instructed them not to give the warning? Isn't that clear evidence of what the FDA would have done had SmithKline proposed a warning on Paxil?
No, Your Honor. The answer is this. Even in 2007, when the FDA it issued the class warning with respect to pediatrics in 2005 and 2007, in 2006, GSK had proposed a suicide warning that applied to adults of all ages. In 2007, the FDA enhanced the black box warning and said, no, just, you know, the black box goes up to the age of 24, which includes Tricia Mason in this case. GSK thereafter asked the FDA, what about our Paxil-specific warning? And the FDA told GSK, you know what, submit a new supplement and we'll analyze it. Indeed, both the Tucker decision issued by Judge Hamilton as well as the Forrest decision looked at that fact and said the FDA, even though it may treat a black box warning as a class label, still permits the manufacturer to issue drug-specific warnings in other portions of the label, including the general warning sections.
But why should what takes place after 2003 inform us on what the FDA would have done prior to 2003? And so what I'm getting at is prior to 2003, they specifically declined additional warnings on Prozac, and isn't there reason to believe, whether this amounts to clear evidence, who knows, but reason to believe that they would have similarly declined a warning on Paxil?
Well, Your Honor, if prior to 2003, there was no class warning. The class warning first was implemented in connection with the pediatrics, which occurred in fall of 2004. Prior to 2003, there was no class warning. And in fact, if one looks at the labels of the drugs, they have different warnings. For example, Prozac has a prominent warning relating to rashes. GSK's does not. These are individual drugs. If they were all the same, we would be here, GSK would be here on a patent claim. They're different drugs. They have different pharmacokinetic properties. They're excreted from the body differently, and they're absorbed by the body differently. So if GSK knows that its drug has a risk specific or unique to its drug, it has a duty to warn, and Levine suggests that. That way doctors have a better understanding of what risks are associated with which drugs and know which drugs is best for a specific patient. If they're all the same, there would be one drug. Following Levine's the decision in Levine has resulted in a domino effect. Namely, Colachico, the Third Circuit's decision in Colachico, was vacated by the Supreme Court, as well as by the Third Circuit itself. Furthermore, the FDA has withdrawn its pro-preemption amicus briefs. And further, in May 2009, the White House issued a memorandum prohibiting federal agencies from cavalierly preempting state law.
Right. There's no question that the legal landscape has significantly changed since the district court decided this case. But I agree with Judge Simon that the case really turns on what degree of evidence will satisfy the Supreme Court's clear evidence rule from Wyeth versus Levine. And I'd like to know what universe of evidence we're looking at here, because I don't think the preemption issue as a threshold defense to liability ought to be collapsed with the merits here. And it seemed to me that a lot of your brief focused on merits-related issues that will ultimately be important to liability if there is no preemption, but that we ought not to to confuse those two issues. So
well,
what subset of evidence should we be looking at? Just the regulatory history here of Paxil, or something more than that?
I think all we need to look at for the purposes of preemption is whether GSK was prohibited from issuing an enhanced warning or issuing a suicide warning to begin with, because there was no warning at the time.
Well, that's kind of an extreme position. That requires that they actually submit a new warning and that it be rejected in order for the preemption defense to be triggered. I'm not sure that extreme is warranted by the Levine case.
Well, in Levine, the manufacturer proposed something different. And if you look at the dissent's opinion, and the dissent outlines that the plaintiff's attorney, and this is in footnote one in the dissent's opinion, the plaintiff's attorney actually said, listen, the warning that they wanted, they should have given and gave in 1987 but was rejected, that would have saved Ms. Levine's arm. That would have prevented this injury from occurring.
I thought Judge Stevens' majority opinion rejected that view of the record.
And the majority, however, well, it's clear that something was proposed. I think both the majority as well as the dissent agree that something was proposed, and the FDA said keep current verbiage. But that demonstrates that even when the manufacturer proposes something and the FDA rejects it, that even in that extreme context, you're not going to find preemption. Here, GSK never proposed anything, nor did the FDA ever go to GSK and say, well, sua sponte, we don't want you to issue a suicidality warning. You will not find that anywhere in the record. And the only evidence that GSK relies upon is the citizen petitions dealing with Prozac. Prozac is a different drug. Furthermore, in denying those citizen petitions, the FDA stated, you know, we do not believe, we're not saying that there is no risk.
But you keep saying, obviously, it's a different drug and it's a different manufacturer, but the original precaution for Paxil was identical to the precaution for Prozac, correct?
Because GSK chose to propose, the manufacturer proposes its label, and GSK, in order to compete with Prozac, put the identical suicide precaution that Prozac contained. It's not like the FDA said use that. The GSK proposed it. GSK could have proposed a stronger warning. It was never prohibited from doing that. And if the citizen's petition, again, courts that have analyzed the citizen petition, in particular the Modus Court in 2000, held that the FDA never stated that it would be impermissible to include additional warnings. Even in responding to the citizens' petitions, the FDA stated that a court finding would be relevant in its determination of whether a risk exists. And in the context of Paxil, in 2001, a federal jury in Wyoming, concluded that Paxil contributed to the suicidal and homicidal acts of a patient. And that ruling was confirmed by the federal court. And I'm referring to the Tobin versus Smith Beecham Kline case.
Did they even press a conflict preemption defense in that case?
No, they did not. So either they must concede that they committed some form of malpractice if it was so clear, or, as plaintiffs suggest, there is no preemption, that this is basically a recent event arising out of the pro-preemption FDA policies that the Supreme Court has since rejected. And finally, I think the most critical fact in this case is tab 3 of our appendix, which is the 1999 memorandum by GSK senior scientist Dr. Daniel Burnham. Dr. Burnham in 1999 analyzed GSK's data and said, listen, there looks to be a risk here that Paxil, when I'm looking at the data, patients on Paxil experience suicidal behavior more frequently than patients on placebo. And this contradicts everything that we have previously reported in literature and to the public and medical community. And he recommended that this needed to be reconciled, in particular needed to be reconciled with a favorable article that GSK had written, the Montgomery Dunbar article. GSK never followed its own employee's advice. Its own employee was telling it, listen, we have a risk, and GSK never did anything about it. Instead, it waited until 2006, the same year that its patent was about to expire, before informing the medical community of the serious nature of this risk. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Mr. Justafford. Good morning, and may it please the court. I think the place to start is the FDA regulation that says a manufacturer may add a warning to a label only if it is supported by reasonable evidence, only if there's reasonable evidence of an association between a serious hazard and a drug. At the time in question, there was no such evidence, and FDA had repeatedly determined over and over that there was no such evidence. That means that GSK could not, under FDA's regulations, have made the warning at issue here, and that FDA, based on its own determinations of no evidence, could not have approved it. That also means that any effort by GSK to nonetheless do so would have thwarted what FDA scientists described as their own effort to balance the risks against the benefits of Paxil. Now, why does that all matter? For three reasons. First, in Wyeth v. Levine, the Supreme Court squarely held that there is preemption, at least where there is clear evidence, as you were referring to, clear evidence that FDA would have rejected the warning label in question. I believe that's undisputed. Second, as I was saying, there's overwhelming such evidence in this case. And if I could detail that evidence, we rely on a few things. First, as of the time in question, March of 2003, no study, no matter how it was run, no matter how many times it was done, ever showed an increased risk for adult Paxil use and suicidality. None.
Adult ever. Or young adult?
There no
You're
study as of the
18 to 24 year olds here.
Right. This case involves a young adult.
Right.
As of March of 2003, no study had ever showed an increased association for any adult. And FDA had specifically made that determination from the very time it approved Paxil and through June of 2003, which was 3 months after the events at issue here. When FDA first approved Paxil, it specifically requested information from GSK about suicidality because it knew it was an issue.
Why couldn't the memo that your scientists wrote in 1999 where it said if you exclude the run-ins from the placebo category, if I understand that correctly, that there's a higher causation or a higher suicide rate amongst people on Paxil than those in the placebo? Why isn't that enough to be reason to believe that would prompt your client to, under this CBE process, propose a warning? And you can do that without the FDA approval at all.
Right. When we went back and reran that, or when GSK went back and reran that study to fix for a couple things that people viewed as errors in the study, the result was the same. This was in what happened. The email you're referring to from December of 1999. There was a GSK employee who identified that the run-in data had been included in the studies back in 89 and 91. By the way, that was nothing new. That was disclosed by GSK to FDA at the time, and FDA scientists in the record said they knew of that. So this was nothing new. But in 1999, the GSK employee identified that. It seemed wrong to him, so he called FDA, and they said, yes, that was inappropriate. When GSK, but the employee at that point pointed out in a short email, it's in the record, that you know if you change the numbers, you change the numbers, right? But he didn't go back and do a formal study to figure out exactly what the results would be.
No, what he said is it increases the risk. The risk is increased for Paxil versus the placebo.
Well,
and the question is, why isn't that reason to believe that would prompt your client to warn under this process by which they can warn without getting the approval of the FDA?
Right. And he did sort of the basic obvious point, which is if you take some numbers out here, that surely you know would have some impact on the results, right? But the question still remains, is there actually, you know, scientifically, statistically significant evidence of an increased association? And in 2002, GSK submitted to FDA results of one of the studies that it did. It did a number of studies at the time period. One was to say, we're going to take just the data from back then, 89 and 91, and we're going to do two things differently this time. We're going to exclude the run-in information, and we're also going to exclude the uncontrolled studies, because controlled studies are much more reliable than uncontrolled ones. And when GSK ran that study, the study showed that there was no increased risk for any adults. And that was true of every study that had ever been done. A similar point applies to one of the arguments they make also is that GSK had coded some information, suicidality-related information, as emotional lability, which is a broad category that refers to a wide variety of extreme emotional states. And in February of 2003, GSK submitted a study, also in the record, that again did not implicate that issue. The way the tests were, the way that, and it is explained in our appendix, if you look at the study, the way the test was run was to pull out everything involving suicidality, regardless of how else had been coded, and the results of that came back the same as every study that was ever done until 2006. Every study done until 2006, 3 years after the events at issue here, said no increased risk for any adults. And
The 2006 study was based on the same data, is that right?
No, this is another important point. The 2006 study differed from prior studies in two significant respects. One is that it was based on data that was gathered through May of 2005. When you're doing a study in 2005 or 2006, you use the most recent data. And the study itself on this point is in the record behind tab 12 of our appendix. And if you turn to the, I'm afraid it's the eighth unnumbered page, as a base number 2 at the bottom, I know that's not terribly helpful. But there's a chart there that says that that shows the difference between prior study and this one. It says this one includes data through May of 2005, which is what you would expect because the whole point of the 2006 study was to update things, to do the state of the art. There was a new methodology that Columbia University developed in 2004. The idea was to do the latest and greatest, and the notion that the latest and greatest would have been done with data that was solely from the 1980s is just implausible. Now, the one thing that they cite for that that's contrary to what the report actually says is they have some subsequent deposition testimony in another case of an employee who remembered it, including data from the 80s. That's true to the extent that the data went all the way back to the 80s, but to the extent that that somewhat garbled transcript is read to mean it had only 80s data, that's not only implausible, but it's also, I mean, the evidence to look to is what the study itself says, and of course it had the most recent data. That was the whole point. The other thing that was crucial, besides the new methodology and the updating the data through May of 2005, was that it was FDA's results in its 2006-2007 study that were the most important, because they're the ones that did show a statistically significant increase for young adults. GSK's study didn't actually show that. And the reason the FDA was able to do that is that the FDA and FDA alone has access to all of the manufacturer's data. And the FDA decided for the first time to get a great new data set, combine all the manufacturer's data, and then study the data in ways that no one ever could with a more limited data set. And one of the things they did was, one, they had a huge amount of data. And two, because of that, they broke the data down in lots of different ways, lots and lots and lots of different ways that no one else had done before. And that's what, for the first time, showed that there was a statistically significant increase for young adults. But that was well after the fact. And in terms, though, of the ultimate question here is, what would FDA have done in March of 2003? And there was some questioning about what's clear evidence. And I'd say we have clear evidence here in two respects. The first is that, as I said, the standard for labeling change is whether there is reasonable evidence of an association. And here, FDA opined from the time it approved Paxil through June of 2003, 3 months later, that there was no evidence. And whatever reasonable evidence is, it's more than no evidence.
But that's based on incomplete information.
It was based on all of the up-to-date information that was available at the time. I mean, there were studies that were done later.
I thought during this time period there was a question about how your client was coding events and so forth.
Yeah, there are, I mean, plaintiffs make a number of allegations, obviously. They seem to boil down to three things: the inclusion of run-in data, which we talked about.
The inclusion
of data from the run-in period of some of the studies back in 89 and 91,
right,
which we talked about. When we later ran that study, it made no difference. And it was disclosed to FDA at the time. Second, the fact that some of these events were coded as emotional lability, which is the one that you referred to.
Right.
First, again, the fact that there was suicidality was never hidden from FDA. FDA knew about it and was asking about it from 90. What happened was that for running some studies, terms and connectors type searches, it's not quite like that, but that's the best analogy for a lawyer like me. These events were coded under a fairly broad category of emotional ability, which refers to a wide range of emotional states. But when FDA later broke that out and did a study in February of 2003, the month before here, that pulled up everything, regardless of how it was coded, the result was the same as ever, which is that there was no...
You mean it accepted, it converted the data that coded these events as emotional lability to suicidality?
What it did is, if you looked at one of these charts, what it would say is there'd be what's called a preferred term, which here was emotional ability. There then, in the same data set next to it, there's a narrative description, and it would say something more specific that would lend one to know that what we're talking about was suicidality. It might say suicidality, or it might say something else like poison or rope. And so what GSK was able to do was to go back and rerun the studies looking not at emotional ability, but at the narrative description. And when it did that in February of 2003 and gave the results to FDA, it got the same result as always, which is that there was no association. And that's what FDA was looking at. In June of 2003, FDA was looking at the studies that GSK gave it in 2002 and 2003 that showed the same results as always for adults, for all adults. And that's what's so crucial, is that it was just 3 months after this, based on the latest and best data, that FDA concluded that there was, quote, no evidence of an association between Paxil use and suicidality in any adults. And it drew a different conclusion for pediatrics, of course, but that's why the June is so powerful. FDA was focused on this, looking at the data, and said we have concerns about children but not adults. And the no reasonable evidence language that FDA used is not happenstance. That's FDA talk under its regulations for no basis for a warning. And FDA had said the same thing when it approved Paxil, when scientists said there was, quote, no signal or no suggestion. And in the meantime, the Prozac studies are critical because, as Your Honor said, FDA has always wanted the suicidality warnings, different for some other things, but the suicidality warnings, FDA has always wanted to be exactly the same on all these drugs because it thinks that they're the same for this purpose. And throughout the 90s, FDA rejected citizen petitions that would have required the same warning at issue here. And the reason it gave was that there was no reasonable evidence of an association, which is the same finding that it had made before, during, and after with respect to Paxil, straight through to 2006.
Would you discuss how the City of Joliet case works here? It seems to me that it really hurts your argument. How would you address it? You address it in a footnote in your brief, kind of giving it the back of your hand, but it seems to be a pretty fairly dispositive to me. Can you tell me why it's not?
Sure. We don't think so for two reasons. And I hate talking about cases that someone on the panel helped decide. Seems wrong to me, but I will anyway. The first point is that that's a housing and urban development case, not an FDA case. And why, in the FDA context, identify the specific clear evidence standard that you referred to earlier. So it's the clear evidence standard that governs here. Second, the reasoning of City of Joliet, as I understand it, was the court said that it would not, that if, when preemption was being inferred from broad goals and objectives, it would not have an expansive interpretation of preemption without an agency regulation on point. But here, and I think this is the reason for the Supreme Court's clear evidence standard, we're not relying on broad goals and objectives, and we're also not seeking a particularly expansive interpretation. We're relying on FDA as a regulation that says you can't make the label change unless there's clear, reasonable evidence of an association. Here, there was no evidence, and FDA said there was no evidence. And so we're not relying on something more pie in the sky. We're not relying on FDA's mere approval of the label, which is what the Supreme Court ruled out in Wyeth. And I think that's what the HUD case was talking about. But I could be corrected if I misunderstood that. But the Paxil labeling, then again, is critical because it also, we don't think it's necessary, but it certainly confirms our point. Also, I ended up talking a lot about the evidence concerning basically the allegations of fraud in the FDA that plaintiffs had alleged. But we also agree with the district court that that's not legally relevant because under Buckman, inquiries concerning basically what we gave FDA are for the FDA and FDA alone. And in a typical case like this, Buckman probably would not be implicated. But here, because it is so clear that FDA would not and could not have approved the labeling in question at the relevant time, and in fact had rejected it up until then, the only way the plaintiffs can try to get around preemption here is to say that FDA's determinations shouldn't count because they were infected by GSK misleading, which is to say defrauding FDA. And when that issue is teed up as a key issue, that's exactly what Buckman said is FDA's prerogative. So for that reason, we think you could affirm the district court without getting into all those other facts that the district court did not find relevant. I also, one thing I should emphasize, too, is there's been some discussion thus far about the facts of Wyeth, and mostly it's dealt with the dissent's view of the facts in Wyeth. I mean, the majority in the dissent did disagree about the facts there, and the majority said that the warning that was rejected in Wyeth was not material to the question there and that it was rejected for stylistic reasons. And that's right. The warning that had been rejected there had nothing to do with the specific risk that was at issue there, which was IV push. And if the court does not, the one other thing I would add too is FDA, it's not just that FDA made these determinations, it exhaustively considered this issue for almost 15 years. I mean, these were high quality, focused FDA determinations. And when FDA spends this much time on something and specifically opines on it, that's what gives rise to a very specific conflict. That's the same conflict that the Supreme Court said in Wyeth does in fact exist. We're not relying on FDA's mere approval of a drug's labeling. We're saying that when FDA looks at the specific issue and there's no evidence of the issue and FDA says so, that's controlling because the key FDA regulation, which I don't think was discussed before I got up here, says that you can't have a change to the drug's labeling unless there is reasonable evidence of association. And here there was simply none. Thank you.
The key fact in this case is the 1999 memorandum by Dr. Burnham. Dr. Burnham did the analysis and reached the conclusion that Paxil is associated with a greater increased risk of suicidality than placebo.
That was submitted to the FDA, right?
That was not, his memorandum was not submitted to the FDA. And I'd like to read a portion of the record. This is tab 5. This is, Dr. Burnham did his memorandum in November of 1999. GSK and gave it to GSK. GSK saw it and realized there was a problem. GSK contacted the FDA, and this is a memorandum written by GSK memorializing the phone call. In addition, I raised a hypothetical example for his consideration. I inquired about his interpretation of classifying placebo run-in deaths. Specifically, I asked if a patient were to die during placebo run-in, i.e. prior to randomization, should that patient be included in the calculation for placebo deaths? He clearly stated that such a patient should not be counted in our analysis, since such a patient would not compromise the controlled portion of the trial. They raised a hypothetical scenario, yet that is exactly what they had done. Instead of contacting the FDA and saying, listen, this is what we did, and we'd like to issue a warning because now we realize we made a mistake, they raised a hypothetical, and they waited until 2006, relying upon this exact same data, to find that Paxil was associated with an increased risk of suicidality, which was statistically significant for patients of all ages. And that was based on Paxil's specific data. It didn't require data from the other manufacturers.
I'm sorry, what's the chronology? The information that was provided to the FDA in 1999 about this run-in period was what?
In 1999, Dr. Burnham did the analysis.
Right.
GSK contacted the FDA in a phone call and raised it as a hypothetical and said, hey, we want to know, do we count this hypothetically speaking? And the FDA said, no, you don't count that. So confirming what Dr. Burnham had determined. And GSK thereafter never bothered to present Dr. Burnham's findings to the FDA. It never occurred.
Until 2006.
In 2006 is when it submitted its analysis and confirmed and to the medical community the Dear Doctor letter finding the risk. Given the fact that the 2006, it didn't constitute result in a misbranding action or anything, and was based on data available since 1980s, and page 142, which is one of GSK's representatives, testified that the 2006 labeling change was based upon data from the 1990s and the 1990s and the 1980s. May I have additional 2 minutes to give a closing statement?
Sure.
Thank you. As I began preparing for today's argument, I reviewed many of the cases that the parties had cited. One of the cases that we had cited in our brief was the 1852 decision in Thomas versus Winchester, which stood for the proposition that plaintiffs for years have been able to sue pharmaceutical manufacturers as a result of injuries that they sustained. In Thomas, the manufacturer attempted to escape liability by arguing that they did not have a duty to warn the plaintiff. In rejecting this argument, the Court of Appeal made the following statement. So highly does the law value human life that it admits of no justification wherever life has been lost and the carelessness or negligence of one person has contributed to the death of another. I juxtapose that with the ruling of the district court below, which held not all tragedies have legal remedies, and excused GSK from all accountability and liability, even though its negligence and recklessness caused the death of Tricia Mason. While 150 years have elapsed since the Thomas ruling, its principles, I hope, continue to hold true today, that the law does value human life and admits of no justification wherever life has been lost as a result of the recklessness of another. If those ideals continue to hold true, then GSK should not be allowed to justify its negligence and recklessness by arguing that the FDA had not ordered it to issue a more timely warning. Thank you.
I'll give you another minute if you want to chat with us a little bit more.
Well, thanks, Ben. I will be brief.
Obviously, you're going to be brief. But.
I'll be brief, and I will also limit myself to the discussion of the 1999 email, because it sounded like that was what you most recently heard about and might be interested in. This deals with the issue of the studies from the run-in data. And if I could just emphasize the following. First, when FDA gave those studies to FDA, when GSK gave the studies to FDA as part of the new drug approval process, GSK told FDA right in the same tables that contain the information that the run-in data were excluded. And GSK's scientist, when he then did his own study, indicated that he knew that. So there's no question of hiding the ball here from FDA. And that information is behind tabs 3 and 5 of our brief appendix. Tab 3 on pages 1 and 16, tab 5 on page 23. In 1999, when the GSK employee identified it, he did check with FDA, and they did say that had been inappropriate. GSK didn't wait till 2006. It did then rerun the study I was talking about, which GSK submitted in May of 2002. And that study, as I indicated, and this is behind tab 11 in 2002, did two things. It took that old data and it tried to rerun that very same old data to address two concerns that have been raised. First, it excluded the run-ins, And second, it excluded uncontrolled studies because controlled studies are more reliable than uncontrolled ones. And looking at
one question here, just kind of globally, why does the FDA, if it does, care about adding more warnings? I can see when you have an approved label that you certainly can't, on your own, delete a particular warning.
Mm-hmm.
But why not? Why would they care if you added?
Well, I'll tell you what FDA scientists said in January of 2004 when they were reviewing the Paxil data itself, when they were talking to their scientific advisory committee. And they said that erring in either direction can have adverse consequences. Omitting a warning can have adverse consequences. But depression...
You know, the amicus briefs talk a lot about the danger of over-warning. But I don't know if I can see why that would be present in a case like this. I know if you, the more warnings you put on, the less marketability you have of your drug. But
just looking at this is behind tab 16 of our brief, pages 2-3. What the FDA scientist said about Paxil when he was talking to the scientific advisory committee was that the concern is that depression kills. It has other serious and debilitating consequences. And before you discourage people from taking what could be a life-saving treatment, you need evidence that it's a good idea to discourage them from that. And that's codified then also, and that's the reason for FDA's reasonable evidence of an association standard. And when FDA codified that in 1979...
To require it. Yeah, I can understand that to require it, but to... I don't know why a drug manufacturer can't, on its own, increase the warnings without FDA approval.
It's the point I was making, that if the tort system were to drive manufacturers, and FDA said this in 1979 in the Federal Register when it promulgated its rules, so it's not us, it's FDA saying this. If the tort system drives a manufacturer to make warnings that aren't scientifically substantiated, that can deter what are otherwise very beneficial uses of drugs. And FDA is doing a risk-benefit analysis here. And that, obviously, for preemption purposes, it's only relevant where FDA has actually done it. But here, there's overwhelming evidence that FDA was looking at this issue and is finding that there was no evidence, and that's why it denied those citizen petitions throughout the 90s.
Okay. Well, thank you to both counsel. Very interesting case. The matter will be taken under advisement, and we'll proceed to...